would rather not have recovery if the revival of private initiative means a resumption of private control in the management of corporate business. The essence of the New Deal, he continued, is the reduction of private corporate control by collective bargaining and labor legislation, on the one side, and by restrictive, competitive, and deterrent government action, on the other side. In fact, many of the New Dealers had been advocates of massive government intervention in the economy, even before the stock market crash of 1929. To achieve these ends, FDR and Secretary of the Treasury Henry Morgenthau turned on the federal spending spigot to full blast. Between 1933 and 1940, Roosevelt more than doubled federal spending, from $4.6 billion to $9.5 billion. Federal outlays amounted to 3.7% of GNP in 1930. By 1940, they were 9.1%. Many apologists like to argue that FDR's spending spree was the result of World War II, but that is simply not true. Until the actual outbreak of the war, there was little increase in military spending to speak of. Virtually all of the increased federal spending was for domestic programs, along with helping to elect political allies who would further his agenda. In Pennsylvania, for example, the New York Herald Tribune reported, "The Democrats are moving heaven and earth to elect Joseph Guffey to the U.S. Senate and the whole Democratic ticket." The paper noted that Guffey does not hesitate to use the enormous sums already poured into the state of Pennsylvania by the federal government as a reason for voting for Democrats. Guffey even noted on his campaign literature that under Roosevelt, Pennsylvania had received $678 million in federal money, even though they had paid only $298 million into the U.S. Treasury. This same practice was going on all around the country. The man who oversaw both the Works Progress Administration and the Federal Emergency Relief Act funds was Harry Hopkins. He admitted that the relief dollars could be used for partisan purposes. "I thought at first I could be completely non-political," Hopkins is quoted as saying by Robert E. Sherwood, a former FDR speechwriter. "Then they told me I had to be part non-political and part political. I found out that was impossible, at least for me. I finally realized that there was nothing for it but to be all political." Predictably, spending exploded. In just 4 years, Roosevelt borrowed almost as much money as all of the dead presidents who came before him combined. The result of all this spending was a much larger debt, but not much else. In 1939, an exasperated Treasury Secretary Morgenthau admitted that the policies were not working. "We have tried spending money. We are spending more than we have ever spent before, and it does not work. And I have just one interest, and if I am wrong, somebody else can have my job. I want to see this country prosperous. I want to see people get a job. I want to see people get enough to eat. We have never made good on our promises. I say after 8 years of this administration, we have just as much unemployment as when we started, and an enormous debt to boot." The Ultimate Stimulus Plan. So if Franklin Delano Roosevelt's massive explosion of spending only made the Depression worse, what ended it? The easy answer is World War II, but the real answer is actually more complicated than that. The war effort required immediate revenue, so Congress passed and FDR signed the Current Tax Payment Act of 1943, which created the tax withholding system that still exists today. The effect was dramatic. While the top tax rate increased 6 percentage points from 1943 to 1944, the amount of tax revenues collected soared 82%. Unfortunately, there was still the little issue of an exploding national debt. Putting it in terms of $2,009, the debt went from $659 billion in 1940 to a jaw-dropping $3 trillion in 1946. The debt would not reach those heights again for another 38 years. Roosevelt died during his fourth term in office. He had spent much of his time in charge throwing darts, grasping at straws, and hopping from one failed policy to the next. But despite his cluelessness, FDR understood one enduring truth about government welfare. Government dependency, he said, could be a narcotic, a subtle destroyer of the human spirit. In the decades to follow, progressives, like Lyndon Johnson, who idolized FDR, would rise to power. Unfortunately, many of them came to take Roosevelt's view on government dependency as a narcotic very seriously. After all, once you are in the business of dealing drugs, your number one priority becomes getting as many people hooked on them as possible. Teachable moment. By the end of 2010, America's debt will represent 62% of the nation's economy, finally eclipsing the previous all-time high that was reached by FDR during World War II. Congratulations, America!
I'll have them niggers voting Democrat for 200 years. President Lyndon Baines Johnson discussing the Civil Rights Act of 1964 with two governors. Chapter 7, The 60s and 70s, A Summer of Love, Two Decades of Spending. Being a progressive really demands a heightened level of self-assurance. Confiscating people's hard-earned money to build a series of government bureaucracies that then redistribute that money as you deem equitable isn't really for everyone. It helps to have an ego, be a little cocky, maybe even a little arrogant. Fortunately for those in the 1960s who wanted more of everything for everybody, Lyndon Baines Johnson fit the progressive mold perfectly. The evidence? As president, he once relieved himself on the leg of a Secret Service agent. When the agent jumped back in horror, Johnson told him, "That's all right, son. It's my prerogative." Now that is ego.
The real LBJ. In order to understand why LBJ made his policy decisions, it's important first to understand the way he carried himself and treated others. This story, included in one of the many biographies of LBJ, tells you all you really need to know. LBJ felt the need to humiliate others. For Johnson, love too often meant submission, and once a man submitted, Johnson despised him. Crudity was a favorite weapon. With great glee, LBJ described a delicate Kennedyite whom he dragged into the bathroom to continue a conversation. "He found it utterly impossible to look at me while I sat on the toilet." LBJ badgered him to come closer so that they could talk. Then began the most ludicrous scene I had ever witnessed. Instead of simply turning around and walking over to me, he kept his face away from me and walked backward, one rickety step at a time. It certainly made me wonder how that man had made it so far in the world. Given that story, I think the same thing can be wondered about LBJ himself. Lyndon Johnson's soaring sense of personal entitlement also helps to explain his serial philandering and cheating on his wife, Lady Bird Johnson. She once explained to a friend that the trouble was that her husband loved people, and half the people in the world are women. Johnson's extreme elitism also explained why, despite his manufactured civil rights persona, he was really a seething bigot who felt racially superior to the minorities he used for political leverage. Indeed, it's hard to find a modern U.S. president with a worse civil rights record than LBJ prior to becoming a hero of the movement. Award-winning LBJ biographer Robert Caro recounts that prior to 1957, Johnson had never supported civil rights legislation, any civil rights legislation. In the Senate and House alike, his record was an unbroken one of votes against every civil rights bill that had ever come to a vote. Against voting rights bills? Against bills that would have struck at job discrimination and at segregation in other areas of American life, even against bills that would have protected blacks from lynching. But there was more. Johnson considered himself to be so superior to the rest of humanity that he hurled a constant barrage of racist attacks at blacks who served him daily. Johnson's longtime limousine chauffeur and black employee, Robert Parker, wrote in an autobiography that covers the years he spent working for LBJ that Johnson called me boy, nigger, or chief, never by my name. Whenever I was late, no matter what the reason, Johnson called me a lazy, good-for-nothing nigger. I was afraid of him because of the pain and humiliation he could inflict at a moment's notice. I relay this story not to smear a former president, but because understanding the role that elitism and narcissism play in progressivism is extraordinarily important. Those who believe that the founders erred, that the Constitution is imperfect and the country unexceptional, develop those opinions because of the way they view humanity. They are the enlightened, educated leaders and know what's best for the masses in virtually every facet of life, from relationships to diet to money. Minority vote equals majority of the vote. Despite his Texas cowboy shtick, Lyndon Baines Johnson was a true progressive at heart. In fact, he wasn't just any progressive. He was a New Deal progressive who wanted to build on what FDR had already started: the transformation of America toward a cradle-to-grave, European style of government. Following FDR, Presidents Truman and Eisenhower attempted to return America to its tradition of fiscal responsibility. In 1946, the national debt had been nearly 122% of GNP, but by 1960, it had declined to less than 56%. Over the 14-year period from 1947 to 1960, America's total deficit was just $740 million, compared to FDR's deficit of $15.9 billion in 1946 alone. But to progressives, that wasn't an achievement. That was an invitation. By the time LBJ got into office, the crisis in America wasn't economic, but racial. Either way, to progressives, a crisis is always an opportunity, and LBJ was up to the challenge. "This is the next and the more profound stage of the battle for civil rights," he said in a speech at Howard University. "We seek not just freedom, but opportunity. We seek not just legal equity, but human ability. Not just equality as a right and a theory, but equality as a fact and equality as a result." What was unsaid, of course, was that LBJ was also seeking a nearly utopian society that he could take credit for, and civil rights were the perfect excuse to push it through. Johnson was uniquely suited for such progressive undertakings since he'd grown up learning how to milk the government system. Before successfully running for Congress, LBJ had run a Texas youth program, but like many progressives, he was missing one important thing from his resume. He'd never spent any time in his adult life working in the private sector. Johnson did have experience, however, in using the welfare state's seductive propaganda to attract key voting blocs. He understood how to appeal to powerful constituencies and special interests that would stand to profit from new social and anti-poverty programs. For example, the affordable housing programs he proposed helped him gain the support of builders, bankers, and real estate agents who all had strong lobbies in Washington and saw it as a money-making opportunity. Johnson also had experience in targeting large voting blocs for political expediency. He reached out to low-income households and disenfranchised African Americans and offered them a classic deal with the devil: vote Democratic and get free government goodies in return. Help me, and you'll be helping yourself. The truth was that LBJ couldn't have cared less about the plight of blacks. What he did care about was his image, and he knew that being perceived as a civil rights crusader would help strengthen it. As the New York Times recounted, Johnson once explained to an aide the importance of squeezing every last drop of public relations benefit out of his appointment of Thurgood Marshall to the Supreme Court. He knew that stealing black votes away from the Republicans, the anti-slavery party that Abraham Lincoln once led, was critical to the Democrats' future. "Son," Johnson told the young staffer, "when I appoint a nigger to the court, I want everyone to know he's a nigger." LBJ targets the history books. Targeting voting blocks with promises is a good start, but to really gain long-term traction, you've also got to reward them for their vote. That, LBJ knew, could be done through federal appropriations, a tactic right out of the drug dealer's handbook. Give them their first hit for free, and thereafter they'll do anything to get more. In Johnson's case, the political payback happened to fit right into his agenda. The only problem was that he needed a catchy name for his plan. His idol FDR had the New Deal, so it would need to be something equally impressive sounding, something that history books could devote entire chapters to, something that would engrave his name next to Teddy's and Franklin's as one of America's favorite presidents, something like the Great Society. Here's how he described it. The Great Society rests on abundance and liberty for all. It demands an end to poverty and racial injustice, to which we are totally committed in our time. But that is just the beginning. The Great Society is a place where every child can find knowledge to enrich his mind and to enlarge his talents. It is a place where leisure is a welcome chance to build and reflect, not a feared cause of boredom and restlessness. It is a place where the city of man serves not only the needs of the body and the demands of commerce, but the desire for beauty and the hunger for community. Another name for that society would be utopia, but little stumbling blocks, such as the fact that men are inherently sinners, wouldn't stand in LBJ's way. So, to help achieve his vision, Johnson put together more than a dozen different committees that would attempt to answer the question, what is a great society? As he explained, we are going to assemble the best thought and the broadest knowledge from all over the world to find those answers for America. Newsflash, we don't need to find the answers. Our founders already gave them to us. The Cult of Affluence. It's easy to sit back and wonder why the public was so willing to go along with Johnson's agenda, but the truth is that the pumps had been primed decades earlier. LBJ was simply taking the next logical step. To understand the Great Society, you first have to understand the mindset shift that occurred in the 20 years leading up to it. Before the New Deal, most Americans were strongly suspicious of federal power. The grand tradition of self-reliance, free enterprise, local control, and a strong civil society voluntarily helping neighbors in need had persisted throughout American history. While the New Deal presented a more activist government, it was World War II that fundamentally altered the relationship between the American people and their government. In order to defeat Germany and Japan, federal power expanded like never before. Washington decided exactly what goods industry would produce and when it would produce it. The federal government even provided Americans with ration books specifying how much meat, gasoline, sugar, and other items they could purchase. It was a scary combination, but big business and government collaborated to run the economy for the sake of winning the war. After the war, some feared another depression. Instead, the American economy continued to prosper. Luxuries that were rare or non-existent before the Depression, televisions, long-distance phone service, jet travel, air conditioning, automatic washers and dryers, interstate highways, became commonplace. Americans moved out of crowded cities and secluded farms into suburban Levittowns that had sprung up practically overnight. The GI Bill opened the college doors for millions of war veterans. Polio was cured, and antibiotics made people healthier. Poverty rates plummeted, and incomes rose. As a result, we got spoiled. In what journalist Robert Samuelson calls the cult of affluence, the American people came to take economic prosperity for granted. It began to be seen as their birthright instead of a dream. But there's a major problem with that viewpoint, aside from the fact that it's completely wrong. If prosperity will continue forever, then why not use wealth to end the last vestiges of poverty, to expand health insurance, and to provide more for retirees? Prosperity was no longer good enough. We demanded utopia. President John F. Kennedy reflected this hubris in his inaugural address by asserting that man holds in his mortal hands the power to abolish all forms of human poverty. The paradox was that poverty was already falling and prosperity was already spreading. But once government got involved to push things further, politicians reversed the very factors, like free enterprise, low taxes, and incentives, that had spearheaded the progress in the first place. In fairness, President Kennedy's vision was more conservative than many have come to believe. He often stated that his goal was to reduce government dependency, not just provide handouts. And he predicted that such new programs would reduce dependency enough to save tax dollars in the long run. It was an economic philosophy that should now sound pretty familiar. In his 1964 State of the Union address, delivered only 2 months after the Kennedy assassination, Johnson proclaimed, "This administration today declares unconditional war on poverty. Total victory," he said, "was the only option." This war rhetoric perfectly matched the mood of the era. America had won World War II by unifying an all-powerful federal government with a tightly regulated business sector in order to achieve a large national goal. So why not bring back the same model to fight poverty? Once again, Washington would establish a national goal, set the course, and the people would fall right into line. It was an extreme version of central planning, and one that citizens of America's rival at the time, the Soviet Union, were already quite familiar with. Great society. But for whom? Johnson's promise to abolish poverty and lead America upward to a great society had all the markings of a religious pilgrimage. He believed that equality of outcomes could only be achieved by forcing those who worked hard and saved their money, those deadheads that Keynesians hate, to redistribute their wealth to others. The problem with that kind of thinking is that no honest economist would ever support it. Smoothing wealth out among the population might be good for growing voter bases, but it's terrible for economic growth. That left LBJ in a bind. How could he convince the public to support something that the data wouldn't? The answer was simple. Just change the data. Johnson and his team based their views on The Other America, a book written by Michael Harrington, a self-professed socialist. In his book, Harrington claimed that millions of Americans were mired in poverty. There was just one problem. His claims lacked serious statistical evidence. Harrington wrote, "I work on an assumption that cannot be proved by government figures or even documented by impressions. A fact can be rationalized and explained away. An indignity cannot." Right, because who needs data when bleeding hearts are all that's required? As the Great Society sales pitch was being made to the nation, Johnson's progressive allies rallied to his cause to offer spin and false hope. In 1961, Keynesian economist Robert Heilbronner declared, "We are closer than any community in history to attaining that bright goal seen by Keynes, an economy without poverty. Indeed, we are almost there." It's no mistake that Johnson chose poverty and civil rights as his two main issues. After all, they were completely intertwined. In 1965, 43% of all black families fell under the $3,000 poverty line. Targeting poverty meant focusing on civil rights and equality. And you couldn't have equality without targeting poverty. Politically, it was a match made in heaven. That fall, LBJ won the election over Barry Goldwater in a landslide, resulting in that rarest of all political gifts, the perceived mandate from the public to push your policies through quickly. "Look," he said, "I've just been reelected by an overwhelming majority. We've got to get this legislation fast. We've got to get it during my honeymoon period." That's exactly what he did. The next year, with the help of a liberal majority in Congress, Johnson rammed through a host of programs, including Medicare, environmental safety regulations, and Operation Head Start, a long-stalled federal aid to education bill. No less a liberal than Ted Kennedy called 1965 a breakout year for the progressive agenda. The following year, LBJ got the Child Nutrition Act passed and, taking a page right out of the progressive playbook, continued expanding the Aid to Families with Dependent Children program. Under Franklin Roosevelt, AFDC had been limited to widows, those who had lost their husbands and now lacked a breadwinner at home to help support the children. That left LBJ and congressional Democrats with an opportunity. Why hook only widows on government support when there are so many other voting blocks that could use a little extra cash? They began to loosen and expand the rules of AFDC eligibility, eventually getting to the point where any woman living alone with children could take advantage of the program. In so doing, they not only bought a large swath of new votes, they also incentivized out-of-wedlock births and single motherhood. Teachable moment. This kind of entitlement expansion is one of the key tactics that progressives continually use to nudge America in the direction they want. The idea is to get a simple, sometimes even reasonable program passed. Then, once the structure is in place, the program can be modified and expanded over time until it eventually bears very little resemblance to the original. The State Children's Health Insurance Plan, SCHIP, is a great example of this. Originally passed in the 1990s, SCHIP was initially supposed to be for poor children who had no access to health care. Sounds like a worthy idea, right? It is, and it has tons of support. But over time, the program was expanded to include middle-class children. States can set income eligibility requirements, and many of them are now at more than 200% of the federal poverty rate. In New Jersey, it was 350% of the poverty level, meaning that a family of four making $77,175 per year was eligible for SCHIP, some poverty program. As Charles Murray described in his classic book, Losing Ground, the Great Society incentivized the same negative behaviors that caused poverty in the first place. It's not simply that people engaged in risky behaviors because they dreamed of a lifetime on welfare. Rather, they became less vigilant about preventing harmful behaviors, in the same way that airbags have been shown to make drivers less vigilant about wearing seatbelts. No longer would the horrifying possibility of a lifetime of poverty be enough to discourage premarital sex or dissuade someone from dropping out of school. People felt liberated to do whatever felt good and not worry about the consequences. They'd be taken care of either way. As a result, millions of women suddenly discovered that they could be better off financially by not marrying. Even low-income parents who wanted to stay together could maximize family welfare benefits by living together but not walking down the aisle. The results have been predictably devastating. In 1960, only 5.3% of all children in America were born out of wedlock. Today, that figure is around 40%. I'll say that again. Nearly 40% of all babies born in America do not grow up in a household with married parents. Think about how little sense this policy makes. Marriage is the greatest anti-poverty program ever conceived. Families rely on two incomes instead of one. Yet LBJ incentivized women to give that up and rely on government support instead. The logic is awful, and the results were even worse. Yet these numbers hide an even greater tragedy. For black Americans, the constituency that LBJ's big government dependency programs were targeting like a heat-seeking missile, the numbers are even more staggering. In the 1960s, 25% of African-American babies grew up without a father in the home. Today, 72% of black mothers are unwed. If you think that happened by accident, think again. LBJ knew precisely what he was doing. All along, Johnson's voting record proved that he had little interest in racial equality. Instead, he knew that shifting black voters into the Democrat column would be a key component for Democratic victories moving forward. The sad truth is that his strategy actually worked. In 1964, LBJ got 94% of the black vote, a record for presidential elections that stood until 2008, when Obama got 96%. In 1965, LBJ signed the Voting Rights Act, and since then, no Republican presidential candidate has ever gotten more than 15% of the black popular vote. Throughout his 5 years in office, Johnson kept whipping out the national credit card and sticking future generations, that's us, with the massive bill. The 5-year price for his Great Society programs, many of which were designed to ensnare and trap the minorities he loved to hate, rang up to an estimated $305.7 billion in 2005 inflation-adjusted dollars. Yet the long-term cost to our way of life is far worse than that. The failure of the Great Society and other federal endeavors to end poverty and create utopia resulted in widespread irresponsibility. Many now expect business and government to ensure that everyone has a job, health insurance, education, food, housing, continually rising incomes, and a comfortable retirement. The responsibility society has become the entitlement society. Most reasonable people understand that there is no escaping the trade-off between economic growth and a large welfare state. Yet many still react to every recession, every bout of unemployment, and every possibility of government cuts with righteous indignation. People expect government to do everything for them, and then they feel cheated when it fails to do the impossible. For example, despite the billions spent, LBJ's so-called war on poverty did nothing to lower the poverty rate. Poor families had more money due to government benefits, but dependency on government for help, which the war on poverty was supposed to solve, had worsened into a multi-generational cycle of poverty. Ronald Reagan may have summed it up best. We declared war on poverty, and poverty won. Two wars, no winners. Tragically, LBJ's war on poverty was not the worst war he ran while in office. In many ways, he fought Vietnam as if it were a social problem to be managed, not a war to be won. Eisenhower had committed advisors to Vietnam to fight off the communist insurgency, but it was LBJ who eventually expanded that to 500,000. With the Great Society and the war happening simultaneously, America was committed to guns and butter. Johnson's hubris once again held disastrous consequences. Ho Chi Minh might have been an America-hating communist revolutionary trained and funded by Moscow, but to Lyndon Johnson, Ho was a reasonable man, a man he could deal with. "If only I could get Ho in a room with me," he explained, "I'm sure we could work things out." Johnson's self-deluded confidence in his own persuasive powers and his fundamental misreading of the enemy's intentions cost the nation oceans of blood and treasure. Given his assumption that Ho would be reasonable, Johnson had designed his policy around that faulty premise. To have any chance of succeeding in the conflict, the military advised him to massively expand the bombing campaign in the north. Instead, Johnson's God complex led him to choose the bombing targets himself during weekly luncheons. Tuesdays worked best for his schedule, with no military representatives present. Johnson and two civilian aides literally sat and handpicked the targets, a process that sounds remarkably similar to FDR's haphazard selection of the cost increase of gold. The reason for this was simple. Johnson, in his infinite progressive wisdom, wanted controlled use of force so as to elicit a cooperative response from the enemy. "We should strive to hurt but not destroy the enemy," said former LBJ National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy, "for the purpose of changing the North Vietnamese decision on intervention in the South." LBJ saw the bombing not as a military effort, but as an act of persuasion, explaining to one aide that his strategy was to view the bombing as seduction, not rape. Ho was apparently the damsel, LBJ the dashing seeker of his affections. This, of course, assumed that Ho was interested in being seduced and could be persuaded, and you know what happens when you assume. The idea that Ho was actually a revolutionary, bent on victory, hostile to everything that the United States represented, never seemed to cross Johnson's mind. Accounts of LBJ's time in the White House are full of scenes in which the puzzled Johnson asks his aides, "What does he, Ho, want?" As if the communist leader were a county commissioner from Texas who could be bought off. LBJ proposed a massive development program in the Mekong Delta region of Vietnam, convinced that it would do the trick. "Old Ho can't turn me down," he said to one aide. He told another, "Ho will never be able to say no to a multi-billion-dollar development project." But Ho Chi Minh, of course, did just that. Another tragic misstep caused by Johnson's massive ego and arrogance. By April 1969, American troops in Vietnam numbered 543,000 with a price tag of $61 billion per year, a figure far eclipsing the administration's estimates of a $5 billion maximum per year. Of course, far costlier than the dollars spent were the lives lost due to a military and public relations strategy designed to persuade the enemy instead of pulverize them. LBJ didn't galvanize Americans by demonizing the enemy, as other war presidents have. He never presented a compelling case as to why it was in America's best interest to wipe out the regime in North Vietnam. Colonel Bui Tin, who served in the North Vietnamese Army, was asked in 1995 what the United States might have done to win. "Cut the Ho Chi Minh Trail," he responded. If Johnson had granted General William Westmoreland's request to enter Laos and block the Ho Chi Minh Trail, Hanoi could not have won the war. Those are painful words of common sense for all American families who lost loved ones in Vietnam. Finally, a real conservative? When the reins of executive power were turned over to Richard Nixon, sadly, not much changed. Although he was a Republican who championed a new federalism, Nixon was no Andrew Jackson when it came to spending and debt. Nixon might have been a law-and-order, fight-the-hippies kind of guy, but he also embraced the central tenets of the New Deal. In fact, there was a strong case to be made that Nixon's economic policies were even more liberal than LBJ's. Building on the Great Society, he nearly tripled anti-poverty spending, taking it from $37 billion to $100 billion in 2009 dollars. His new federalism, which became a slush fund for state and local governments, pushed community development spending by 206%. Worse, it was Nixon who steered Social Security and Medicare onto their inevitable path toward bankruptcy. A month before the 1972 election, he signed into law a permanent 20% increase in Social Security benefits, and then sent all recipients a pre-election reminder of their growing government checks. Medicare spending also rose 246%, and Medicaid spending climbed 120%. And that wasn't the end of his vote buying. Nixon demanded that his cabinet officials spend tax dollars as fast as possible, and he coaxed the Federal Reserve into rapidly expanding the money supply to create an artificial economic boom, a move that contributed to the inflationary chaos of the next decade. Nixon also made things worse by meddling in the marketplace and forever ruining the monetary system. Specifically, he tried to use wage and price controls to manage inflation, which was a predictable and natural consequence of Lyndon Johnson's guns and butter policies. And then there was the final blow to American financial responsibility, the permanent abandonment of the gold standard. By 1944, the major Western powers had signed the Bretton Woods Agreement, whereby a global financial system was created and allied countries agreed to fix their currencies to the U.S. dollar. Everything was fine until 1970, when confidence in the dollar began to slide. President Charles de Gaulle of France started trading dollars for gold, and others soon followed. The following year, in 1971, Nixon responded to de Gaulle by announcing that the government would no longer convert dollars to gold, thereby taking America off the gold standard for good and freeing up the government to print as much money as it wanted. The result, predictably, was massive inflation, especially from 1979 through 1981, when prices rose at a double-digit rate each year. But at least Nixon had one better trait than LBJ. He wasn't a racist, or at least not an overt one. According to his biography, Nixon the Quaker detested racism, though he was unconvinced that all races were in fact of equal intelligence. He thought the East Asians might be the most intelligent, followed by the Caucasians, the Indo-Asians, and the Africans, but they all had equal rights. Oh, I see now. It's considered racism only if you don't think someone should have the same rights as you, even if you think there's no genetic way they can be as smart as you are. If you want to give Nixon a pass on racism, it's much harder to give him one on anti-Semitism. The Jews are all over the government, Nixon complained to his chief of staff Bob Haldeman in 1971 as his problems were mounting. Washington is full of Jews, he continued, and most Jews are disloyal. Then, after carving out exceptions for some of his top aides, such as Henry Kissinger, Nixon added, "But Bob, generally speaking, you can't trust the bastards. They turn on you. Am I wrong or right?" It doesn't really matter if you're a progressive Republican or a progressive Democrat. The common denominator is disdain for some class of people. And it makes perfect sense. It's virtually impossible to govern from a philosophy of manifest destiny without having some serious disdain for intellect, loyalty, and ability of those same masses. MAED. Aside from the growing nanny state, there was another, less obvious but equally as dangerous trend emerging. The new buzzword in international economics was interdependence. When it came to nuclear weapons and military strategy, we operated under a theory called mutual assured destruction. You destroy us, we'll destroy you. In theory, it created a standoff that would make a nuclear missile launch less likely. Elites had been pushing for quite some time to apply the same theory to economics. In other words, if we make countries economically dependent on each other, they will be much less likely to blow each other up. Professor Carol Quigley, a legendary teacher at Georgetown, whose students included Bill Clinton, wrote about this pattern of interactions in his book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. First published in 1966, Quigley predicted a world in which we would see the converging of interests between countries, including the two superpowers, which would begin to move on parallel paths. Moreover, Quigley declared that this was all part of a coherent master plan. The powers of financial capitalism, he wrote, had another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. To save ourselves from nuclear peril, the theory went, we needed to make bank loans to our enemies, create overarching international institutions, and ensure that consumers, governments, and economies would all have a stake in the prosperity of other countries. President Nixon did just that, signing lucrative trade deals with Moscow in the name of securing peace. He actually sold them grain at far below world prices in a move that was later called the Great Grain Robbery. Nixon also publicly stated his support for the idea that peace could be achieved through a more balanced world. We must remember the only time in the history of the world that we have had any extended periods of peace is when there has been balance of power. It is when one nation becomes infinitely more powerful in relation to its potential competitor that the danger of war arises. So I believe in a world in which the United States is powerful. I think it will be a safer world and a better world if we have a strong, healthy United States, Europe, Soviet Union, China, Japan, each balancing the other, not playing one against the other, an even balance. International loans, interlocking financial systems, and global trade were the paths to peace in Nixon's mind. Never mind that during World War I and World War II, leading trading partners such as Germany and Great Britain were blowing each other up. But what no one realized, or at least no one grasped the consequences of, was that a single, giant global economy meant that the fire lines that separate and protect us had to be removed. That left the world vulnerable to a level of financial catastrophe, natural or man-made, that had never before been possible. A few decades later, that global crisis would begin to play itself out. Surveying the damage. Decades after the backlash against New Deal policies and spending had died off, progressives preyed on America's amnesia by pitching a false utopian society where jobs would be plentiful, poverty would be scarce, and the streets would be paved with chocolate. Gold was too taboo. Americans, forgetting what really fueled the post-war boom, pretty much bought it. From 1961 through 1980, annual non-defense spending rose from 9.1% of GDP to 16.8% of GDP, the equivalent today of a $1.1 trillion budget increase. Not surprisingly, the national debt also rose from $293 billion to $909 billion, an increase of 210%, though to be fair, the raging inflation of the late 1970s didn't help. Debt was back, and while economic growth, especially in the 1960s, was substantial, it came at a great long-term cost. By 1981, after enduring decades of JFK, LBJ, Tricky Dick, Ford, and Carter, the great American backlash against liberal policies funded by the future again took hold. The result was an outsider who promised real change, a man who promised to remind Americans that the conventional view on the role of government was wrong, that the founders were not irrelevant, and that their vision was still worth fighting for. A man who told the country that it was morning in America again. And while progressives were once again neutralized by the threat of a fierce enemy abroad, economic growth at home, and a reminder that maximum freedom requires minimum government, they had a plan. This time, they wouldn't wait long to unleash it. We don't have a $1 trillion debt because we haven't taxed enough. We have a $1 trillion debt because we spend too much. Ronald Reagan, 1982. Chapter 8. Ronald Reagan. A shining city on a hill of debt. The 1960s and 70s were pretty tumultuous. A missile crisis, a hostage crisis, assassinations, a resignation, civil rights, women's rights, a Cold War, a hot war, a poverty war, a space race, oil shocks, price controls, inflation, stagflation, and a severe recession. And that was just for starters. By the time 1980 rolled around, the American people seemed to be lost. The Consumer's Confidence Index registered 58.7, a low that wasn't eclipsed for another 28 years. while ABC News Harris polls revealed both widespread pessimism and widespread agreement on the need for dramatic change. 83% of Americans said it was likely they'd postpone a major purchase. 77% thought it was likely that factories would be shutting down within months. 93% thought it was likely that the average family would have a harder time making ends meet over the next 6 months. 84% favored overall cuts to federal spending. 69% favored cutting federal welfare spending. In short, times were tough, and most people thought they'd get even tougher. People wanted accountability and responsibility, both from their neighbors and from their government. Acting on those beliefs, voters threw out Jimmy Carter after one term and elected the original Hope and Change president, Ronald Reagan. The election wasn't even close. A few months later, President Reagan walked out to the terrace of the West Front of the U.S. Capitol and delivered a bold new message to Americans. Government, he said, is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. Reagan continued by taking direct aim at the progressives who had governed the country for so long. From time to time, we have been tempted to believe that society has become too complex to be managed by self-rule, that government by an elite group is superior to government for, by, and of the people. But if no one among us is capable of governing himself, then who among us has the capacity to govern someone else? It was a message that people were finally ready and willing to hear. For all of its allure, progressivism had failed to deliver on its promise of an ever-expanding suite of services with no cost attached. Keynes had convinced people that more government spending would result in more prosperity, that a great society could be bought. It didn't happen. He said that inflation and unemployment could not rise simultaneously, but they did. After years of progressive rule, economic growth was slow, debt was high, and both inflation and unemployment were rampant. People were hurting. Up until Reagan came along, Americans had mostly been willing to allow the government to take more and more of their power. In 1965, when the deficit was just 0.2% of our annual GDP, and the Federal Register, which publishes government rules, regulations, meetings, and the like, was just 13,266 pages, most people were satisfied. Polls at the time showed that only 30% of the public believed that the government had grown too powerful. Barry Goldwater, who'd campaigned for president the year before on an out-of-control government theme, paid a heavy political price for sounding the alarm before people even knew they were under attack, losing in an electoral landslide to LBJ. With Democrats now in control of the Oval Office, the House, and the Senate, all barriers to expansion were gone. 4 years later, with the Great Society in full swing, our economy began to suffer under the weight of a bloated government. Deficits, now totaling 2% of GDP, became the norm, and the Register had jumped to 16,850 pages. Within a few short years, LBJ and Congress had enacted literally hundreds of new subsidies, welfare programs, housing programs, urban programs, and education programs, among others. Americans took notice. The percentage of people who agreed that the government was too powerful jumped from 30% to 40%. By the election of 1980, Americans had endured 11 consecutive years of deficits, and the government's expansion was undeniable. Federal spending, which totaled 19.3% of GDP in 1970, had jumped to 21.7% in 1980. To keep up with the torrent of new programs and regulations, the Federal Register exploded to over 87,000 pages. Polls that year showed that a majority of the public was now ready to acknowledge what Goldwater had campaigned on 16 years earlier. The government had simply grown too powerful. Ronald Reagan, a man who had spent most of his life to that point as a Democrat, was there to tell them they were right. By the end of his first term in office, Reagan had successfully changed the American mindset and spirit. Confidence in the White House rose from 15% in 1979 to 42% in 1984. By the time his re-election campaign came around, many people had taken Reagan's message to heart. He carried 49 states and beat Walter Mondale by the largest electoral margin in history. Americans were ready to believe that it really was morning again in America. Reaganomics Report Card. It's impossible to talk about Reagan's years in office without talking about Reaganomics, a plan designed to combat the slow growth and high inflation that had taken over the economy. It had four key elements. 1. A restrictive monetary policy to stabilize the dollar's value and end inflation. 2. A 25% tax cut at all income levels. 3. A promise to balance the budget through domestic spending cuts and controls. 4. An agenda to ease government regulation. By nearly any measure, numbers 1 and 2 were successful. The Fed, led by Paul Volcker, restricted the money supply by jacking up the federal funds rate, the rate at which institutions lend to each other overnight. Over the course of just 1 year, the rate was doubled, reaching a high of 20% in 1981. For some perspective, the federal funds target range in mid-2010 was 0 to 0.25%. The tax cuts, which were passed as part of the Economic Recovery Tax Act of 1981, did exactly what they were intended to. They brought back economic growth. GDP grew strongly for the rest of the decade. Despite the top income tax rate falling from 70% to 28%, federal revenues rose 19% faster than inflation during the Reagan presidency, from $1.4 trillion to $1.68 trillion in 2009 dollars. More to the point, inflation-adjusted individual income tax revenues expanded 13% despite the Federal Reserve's contractionary monetary policies. Some critics have argued that, as a percentage of GDP, federal revenue actually fell, meaning that the cuts failed. Now think about how ridiculous that argument is. They are basically claiming that tax cuts didn't work because the economy grew too fast. Isn't that the whole point? Lower tax rates encourage working, saving, investing, and productivity, the perfect ingredients for economic growth. Under Reaganomics, the United States economy grew at an average rate of 3.4% a year, beating both the 2.9% average rate during the previous 8 years and the 2.7% average rate over the next 8 years. The inflation rate plummeted from 12.5% to 4.4%. The unemployment rate fell from 7.1% to 5.5% as 15 million new jobs were created. The prime interest rate fell by one-third. Productivity jumped 15%. The S&P 500 leaped 124%, and charitable contributions expanded 57% faster than inflation. In short, tax cuts and a restrictive money policy worked, but Reagan's success with the last 2 points of his plan was far less impressive. In defense of defense. Classic economic ideological battle lines have been drawn over the years. Adam Smith versus John Maynard Keynes, Milton Friedman versus Paul Krugman, although putting Friedman and Krugman in the same sentence is like putting Edward R. Murrow and Keith Olbermann in the same sentence. But things really start to fall apart when it comes to putting these theories into practice. Keynesianism has been implemented in various forms throughout the world and over the decades. Likewise, Krugman's theory, basically a supersized version of Keynesianism in which massive government spending is the best stimulus, was essentially our government's response to the 2008 recession. But when's the last time anyone really tried to run the economy as Adam Smith or Milton Friedman would? The answer is most likely never. Here's the problem. Presidents can occasionally convince the public and the Congress that tax cuts will inspire growth. Coolidge did it. Kennedy did it. Reagan did it, Bush 43 did it, but only Coolidge followed through on the second half of the equation, spending cuts. The rest of them apparently forgot that part. Point 3 on Reagan's list was to balance the budget. He never even came close. When the Gipper took office in 1981, the national debt stood at $2.3 trillion, using 2009 dollars. By the time he left office 8 years later, it had increased to $4.7 trillion. The reason behind that rise is simple. Reagan ran deficits in every single one of his 8 years in office. So that brings up the all-important question, why? Why would Reagan include tax and spending cuts as 50% of his plan and then completely ignore half of that equation? The easy answer is that it was out of his hands. Reagan's budget proposals were one thing, but the bills that actually passed through Congress were something else entirely. The Democrats controlled the House, and starting in 1987, the Senate as well, and went with him on the politically palatable tax cut side, but not on the politically toxic spending cut side. But the real story is a lot more complicated than that. President Reagan once wrote in his diary that the press is trying to paint me as now trying to undo the New Deal. I reminded them that I voted for FDR 4 times. I'm trying to undo the Great Society. Protecting the New Deal meant protecting Social Security, the most expensive entitlement, farm subsidies, farmers vote Republican, and veteran spending, with growing costs from the World War II and Vietnam veterans. Even among the Great Society programs that Reagan seemed to despise, he ultimately decided that fundamentally reforming Medicare, the most expensive LBJ program, was too politically risky. As a result, a lot of government spending was basically immune from cuts or reform. Still, Reagan entered the White House seeking modest spending cuts alongside his tax cut proposals. In 1981, he secured $35 billion in domestic spending cuts, even eliminating the failed Comprehensive Employment and Training Act. The following year, as the deficit rose, Reagan sought deeper cuts. The Democratic Congress offered the president one of their famous deals. For every dollar you raise taxes, we'll cut $3 in spending. Reagan reluctantly agreed to the tax increase and signed the Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act of 1982. But he'd been tricked. A decade later, the president penned a Wall Street Journal op-ed and explained what happened. Despite the assurances, promises, pledges, and commitments you are given, the spending cuts have a way of being forgotten or quietly lobbied out of future budgets. But the tax increases are as certain to come as, well, death and taxes. In 1982, Congress wanted to raise taxes. It promised it would cut federal spending by $3 for every $1 in new taxes. Being a new kid in town, I agreed to this. Unfortunately, although the new taxes went into effect, Congress never cut spending by even a penny. President Reagan's calls for spending restraint were continually undermined by basic special interest politics, undermined by a media that portrayed any minor spending cut as a savage assault on the safety net, and even undermined by his own cabinet members who fought to protect their turf against budget cuts. But the biggest roadblock of all was the Democratic Congress, which used Reagan's number one priority, national defense, against him. Reagan firmly believed that the Cold War was bigger than just the USA versus the USSR. It was a battle of ideologies. It was communism versus freedom, Marxism versus capitalism. The winner would determine what kind of world we lived in for decades to come. As Reagan said years before he took office, "If we lose freedom here, there is no place to escape to. This is the last stand on earth." He reasoned that the national debt wouldn't matter much if we lost the Cold War, and while you can certainly argue about whether he was right, it was what he believed, and he developed his budget to match his principles. In his book, Reagan's War, Peter Schweizer recounted Reagan's rationale through interviews with Reagan advisor Ed Meese and his good friend, National Security Advisor William P. Clark. Disagreements about spending finally came to a head at a cabinet meeting in the White House. "Mr. President, you have double-digit inflation and double-digit unemployment," warned one cabinet member. "You can't spend all of this money on the military. We have to spend it on social programs." Another cabinet member explained that it would create bad publicity to boost spending on guns while cutting the butter. Congress would probably object. It might bust the budget. The debate raged on until Reagan leaned forward and raised his hand to halt the discussion. "Look, I am the President of the United States, the Commander-in-Chief. My primary responsibility is the security of the United States. If we don't have our security, we'll have no need for social programs. We're going to go ahead with these defense programs." Reagan was clear about his priorities from the very beginning. In 1981, he said, "I did not come here to balance the budget. not at the expense of my tax-cutting program and my defense program. This view essentially removed the veto pen from Reagan's hand. If he wouldn't sign the Democrats' domestic spending bills, they wouldn't send him defense spending bills that met his standards. It was, in essence, a domestic version of mutually assured destruction. Reagan does deserve some credit since he did try to rein in spending over the long run, most notably with the Balanced Budget and Emergency Deficit Control Act of 1985. This law, commonly referred to as Graham-Rudman-Hollings, set specific deficit reduction targets with the goal of running surpluses by 1991. The act was good in theory. It required automatic across-the-board spending cuts, sequestrations, if the yearly deficit targets weren't met, regardless of what Congress did. By 1990, the act would have required slashing in excess of 40% from spending on defense and domestic programs in order to meet the target levels. That was more than politicians could swallow, so they did what they always do when they don't like the outcome of the game. They changed the rules and weaseled out of their commitment. Actions speak louder than words. The actual numbers over Reagan's terms tell a conflicted story. According to Veronique de Rougie, a senior research fellow at George Mason University's Mercatus Center, Ronald Reagan sought, and won, more spending cuts than any other modern president. He is the only president in the last 45 years to cut inflation-adjusted non-defense outlays, which fell by 9.7% during his first term. But comparing presidents to each other is a false premise. It's like someone who weighs 400 pounds comparing themselves to someone who weighs 450 and saying that it makes them thin. No, sorry, you're both still fat. Less bad is not the same as good. For fiscal conservatives, presidents should be judged on how they reduce the size, scope, and cost of government over the long term. And by that measure, Reagan didn't do so well. Over his two terms, total federal spending increased 22% faster than inflation. If you look at it as a percentage of GDP, which is only fair because it takes into account how much or little the economy is growing, spending actually decreased from 22.2% to 21.2%. There is also a point to be made that while actions speak louder than words, both sides of the equation matter. Plenty of so-called Republican presidents have vowed to restore limited government and reduce spending, and have then completely ignored those promises once they realized the political sacrifice they'd have to make to follow through. Newsflash, you can't significantly cut spending without making a lot of powerful people very, very angry. But at least Reagan tried. During his first inaugural address, he told Americans, "You and I, as individuals, can, by borrowing, live beyond our means, but only for a limited period of time. Why, then, should we think that collectively, as a nation, we are not bound by that same limitation? We must act today in order to preserve tomorrow. And let there be no misunderstanding, we are going to begin to act beginning today." After 4 years of seeing his proposed budgets changed and his vetoes overridden, Reagan again stood before America and sounded no less optimistic. "A dynamic economy with more citizens working and paying taxes will be our strongest tool to bring down budget deficits. But an almost unbroken 50 years of deficit spending has finally brought us to a time of reckoning. We have come to a turning point, a moment for hard decisions. I have asked the cabinet and my staff a question, and now I put the same question to all of you. If not us, who? And if not now, when? It must be done by all of us going forward with a program aimed at reaching a balanced budget. We can then begin reducing the national debt. I will shortly submit a budget to the Congress aimed at freezing government program spending for the next year. Beyond that, we must take further steps to permanently control government's power to tax and spend. We must act now to protect future generations from government's desire to spend its citizens' money and tax them into servitude when the bills come due. Let us make it unconstitutional for the federal government to spend more than the federal government takes in." On March 25, 1986, the U.S. Senate got within one vote of the two-thirds majority needed for a balanced budget constitutional amendment. But the House never got close, and Reagan certainly never fought for it as much as he implied he would. One vocal critic of Reagan's handling of fiscal matters was his budget director, David Stockman. After leaving the administration in 1985, Stockman wrote a tell-all book about the Reagan administration's economic policy, titled The Triumph of Politics. In it, Stockman laments that the administration failed to follow through on the revolution in small government that it had promised. Evidence that the federal government has gone off the deep end in the conduct of its fiscal affairs continues to mount, Stockman wrote. In 8 years' direction by the most conservative administration in modern times, the federal government spending will have exceeded its income by a staggering sum of $1.5 trillion. He goes on to say, and try not to laugh, historians will undoubtedly find these elephantine figures baffling. Little did he know, those would actually become the good old days. Overall, the Reagan experience should prove to those of us who honestly want to solve this problem that no one person can do it alone. It truly has to be a national effort. Thomas Jefferson himself could take the Oval Office in 2012, and without the firm backing of the people and the unequivocal support of both parties in Congress, our debt would still go up. George H.W. Bush, 1,000 points of debt. My opponent won't rule out raising taxes, but I will. And the Congress will push me to raise taxes, and I'll say no. And they'll push, and I'll say no. And they'll push again, and I'll say to them, read my lips. No new taxes. Presidential candidate Vice President George H.W. Bush, August 1988, at the Republican National Convention. When George Bush ran for the Republican nomination in 1980, he declared Reagan's economic policies of tax cuts designed to spur growth as voodoo economics. But when he joined Reagan's ticket as vice president, Bush was loyal and supported his president's policies, which included raising taxes a total of 13 times in addition to a number of tax cuts. By 1986, the race to select Reagan's successor had begun, and taxation loomed as one of the major issues. Grover Norquist, head of Americans for Tax Reform, had created a No New Taxes pledge and was asking Republican candidates to sign it. A large number of congressional candidates did just that, including Bush's primary rivals Jack Kemp and Pierre Pete Dupont. So Bush, having absolutely no intention to embrace new taxes if elected, signed it as well. Bush, of course, eventually broke his promise, widening the deficit of trust between the public and our leaders and resulting in many people remembering only this one event of his presidency. Like Reagan, Bush had struck a deal with Congress, promising to support raising tax rates in exchange for spending cuts. Also like Reagan, the spending cuts never materialized. But forgotten in the soundbites and political wrangling are the reasons why Bush broke his promise in the first place. Unlike Reagan, Bush was temperamentally and politically cautious. He did not consider himself to be a movement conservative. He saw his job as president to be the cautious steward of the nation. He was humble and didn't take himself too seriously. At the White House, he would sometimes carry around a voice-activated stuffed monkey that would sock itself in the head whenever he, the president, began to speak. To friends, he liked to quote the advice he had been given by a former Republican National Committee chairman named Ray Bliss. Always wait at least a few days before making a difficult decision, because by then, you might not have to decide at all. That might be a good philosophy for staying out of political trouble, but it's not so good for tackling really tough problems like the national debt. But for Bush, there was no other way. His often repeated phrase, "it wouldn't be prudent," wasn't just a throwaway line, it was the way he viewed his job. These personality traits explain a lot, but the more tangible reason Bush broke his promise is that the high rate of economic growth that Reagan enjoyed over his 8 years wouldn't be sustained. Annual GDP growth, which was a healthy 4.1% in 1988, plummeted over the next 3 years to 3.6%, 1.9%, and then a 0.2% contraction in 1991. With growth slowing and spending still increasing, government had to borrow more money to meet its existing obligations. In 2009 dollars, national debt rose from roughly $4.7 trillion in 1988 to $6.2 trillion in 1992, a 32% increase in just 4 years. No matter how you slice it, that's not exactly a fiscal record to be proud of. As a percentage of GDP, things look even worse, if that's even possible. The debt grew from 51.1% of GDP to 64.1%. Like Reagan, Bush was never able to churn out a surplus. President Bush did not enter the White House with a reputation as a spending hawk. The moderate Bush had a more expansive view of government than Reagan and campaigned on creating a kinder and gentler nation, as if President Reagan's America was mean and harsh, and being an environmental president. To many, that was code language for expanding government. At the same time, Bush was also a victim of bad luck. The 1990 recession lowered tax revenues and pushed up the deficit. He inherited a $150 billion tab for the savings and loan crisis. And even worse, he inherited the budgetary time bombs planted by progressives years earlier. Between 1989 and 1993, nominal Social Security costs increased $72 billion, 31%. Medicare outlays soared $46 billion, 50%. And interest payments on our debt, a reflection of all the spending we'd done in previous years, jumped up $30 billion, 18%. To put all of this another way, of the $163 billion in revenue increases over Bush's term, the increases in the three items just mentioned, none of which Bush had any direct control over, chewed up $148 billion, 91% of it. Almost all other spending increases, you may remember Operation Desert Storm, had to be funded by borrowing. Of course, just like with Reagan, none of this excuses Bush's results. The reality is that he presided over yet another expansion of government. But it does put into context just how little control presidents have once entitlement spending and interest payments are on autopilot. It's a lesson that, by the time America put Bush's son into the Oval Office, the country would learn all too well. Bill Clinton. It depends on what the meaning of the word surplus is. The road to tyranny, we must never forget, begins with the destruction of the truth. President Bill Clinton, 1995. Let's get the part out of the way that everyone already seems to know. The Congressional Budget Office reports that Bill Clinton ran surpluses from 1998 through 2001. They were the first surpluses in 28 years. But there's one teeny-weeny fly in the ointment that you won't hear a lot of Clinton supporters point out. Our national debt rose every single year that Clinton was in office. It started at $6.2 trillion in 2009 dollars, when he took office in 1992, and ended at about $7 trillion 8 years later. Compared to other administrations, a 13% increase in the national debt over two terms is something to be celebrated as nearly historic. But in the real world, $800 billion is still a lot of money. So, how did it happen? How could Clinton claim to be running surpluses while our national debt was still climbing rapidly? The answer lies in how the government calculates its numbers and how politicians spin them. But first, a big disclaimer. While I'm about to illustrate how Clinton was able to claim surpluses even though our debt was rising, the truth is that every single president, starting with Reagan, has used the same tactics. The only reason Clinton gets singled out, perhaps unfairly, is that he actually reduced spending more than the others and was therefore into surplus territory. That makes him a bigger target, but the truth is that you can't criticize Clinton for this without being equally critical of President Reagan and both of the Bushes. Follow the breadcrumbs. The complexity of our budget is overwhelming, which I believe is intentional so that the majority of us won't pay attention to it. But when you cut through all the nonsense, there's an extraordinarily simple way to see whether a president was fiscally responsible in reality or just in soundbites. Look at the balance of our national debt. Regardless of what else happens during the year, if there's a true cash surplus, then our national debt would be reduced. If there's a true cash deficit, then our national debt would have to go up because we'd have to borrow the money. There's really no other way. You can't have both a surplus and a higher national debt. Now, back to Clinton. In the fall of 2000, he told America that the recent surplus represented the largest one-year debt reduction in the history of the United States. He also explained, according to CNN, that the $5.7 trillion national debt has been reduced by $360 billion in the last 3 years, $223 billion this year alone. CNN itself reported that the federal budget surplus for fiscal year 1999 was $122.7 billion and $69.2 billion for fiscal year 1998. Those back-to-back surpluses, the first since 1957, allowed the Treasury to pay down $138 billion in national debt. Taken together, those statements clearly imply that Clinton not only ran surpluses and reduced the national debt, but that he reduced it by a record-setting amount. All wrong. Let's start with the actual national debt figures. According to the White House Office of Management and Budget, Clinton inherited a national debt of about $4 trillion. Here is his progress on the debt over his two terms, in trillions. September 30, 1993, 4.351. September 30, 1994, 4.643. September 30,